Welcome to the Org Design Podcast. It's great to be back. My name's Tim Brewer, one of the co-hosts of the podcast. Also, I'm lucky enough to have Amy Springer joining me. And we have Amory from Inclusion Wins. Amory, so good to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us all the way from Switzerland. I have so many questions about how you get to live there. It's on my bucket list of places to spend a chunk of time. So we'll have to take that conversation offline. But maybe we start just by telling us, how did you end up getting into the org design space? What was your journey to org design?
Right. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Tim, Amy. I'm excited for the conversation. So how did I get into the organizational design space? I am an epidemiologist by training, and I got asked to come lead epidemiology and health promotion for a local health department outside of Atlanta, Georgia. I was 27, 28 years old when I got the job. I had never managed anybody, and I got a team of 10. And they were all pretty much older than me and way more experienced than I was. And one of them actually had a son who was born on the same day in the same year, too. So it was like managing my mother. She wasn't quite like my mother, but she definitely helped me as much as my mother has helped. She was one of the most helpful people on the team. And so I was really bad at management. And so I start becoming obsessed with organizational effectiveness, leadership, organization design, and what that looked like. What do we need to do strategy-wise? And I had no clue. I didn't know about Galbraith and Cates. I didn't know about Mintzberg. I didn't know about all these people I came to know later. I wish I would have, but I didn't. But I did go through a redesign, and the result was tragic. And so I began to want to learn more about the process over time as a result.
Thanks, Amory. I think that word tragedy, you aren't the first person to mention that in the context of orgs, reorgs. You've been a leader within organizations. You've since consulted to organizations. Our aim is really to teach and equip leaders like you were when you started, people with a bit more experience. What do you wish you knew when you were starting out?
I wish I would have known emergence and the nature of strategy to be emergent, something that I knew intuitively, but I didn't know technically. The only way you let a strategy emerge is you're doing it with people. And so one principle for us is people commit to what they help to create, getting people involved in strategy early and then letting it blossom, even though you might have something that's fixed, knowing that it's going to shift and actually looking forward to those shifts as you learn. So if I would have learned that early, I probably would have been in a better place to really listen to what my folks were saying that I was engaged with and building capacities across the organizations I've been a part of as a result of having that construct in my head that things are going to emerge and things will change, even though we know it. But I don't even know it was a closeness to it. I just was unaware. And so that blind spot kept me oftentimes from, I think, getting to someplace in a different way and landing at someplace in a different way, rather than oftentimes having to revisit all the stuff that I did before because I didn't take that into account and listen closely enough to that emergence as it was coming into fruition.
A question for like every day, you know, I'm listening to the podcast and I'm leading my organization of 50 or 100 people. How do I know I don't know those things? What are the symptoms that you see in your work or that you've seen over your life of leadership that you didn't see then that are now obvious to you? Like, oh, we have an org design problem, or it's like really obvious you guys are ignoring this thing that's becoming a reality in your organization. What are the kind of practical tips you can give to a leader that's not got to have those experiences that's facing some of those challenges?
I would say, Tim, the one big thing I learned from Robert Fritz, he wrote a book called The Path of Least Resistance. If you're familiar, it's that structure creates behavior. And I'm not talking about just the kind of structural design of your organization, because that's emergent too. But I'm talking about the fact that there's certain ways of being in your culture that drive what your culture is going to do and the actions that it takes. I remember reading a blog from Henry Mintzberg, and he had this picture of an organization, and then he had a second picture, and it was exactly the same as the first, and he called that picture a reorganization. And so if you are creating this kind of organizational structure and then you reorg and it's the same thing, it's not necessarily even the same shape. You might make it a matrix or all these other things that we call organization. But if your behaviors basically stay the same, you haven't fundamentally shifted your organization and moved closer to what you want to see. So if the way we do things around here, our culture is not shifting, even though you've done a reorg, you probably need to go back and figure out what you missed. So my first reorg, and I didn't see it as that at the time, but I came into a health department. I was responsible for epidemiology and health promotion. This probably had 60 to 80 employees across the administrative part. And then there were probably another 150 to 200 that did clinical stuff and stuff in the field. So it was a relatively large geographical area outside of Atlanta. And I came in to reorg infectious diseases and health promotion. There was a really competent person who happened to be quite good at infectious diseases and outbreaks of infectious diseases, sexually transmitted infections. And then there was a whole group that was expert at HIV and tuberculosis, which was a big, big problem with the large immigrant population in the area that we were in. So naturally, to me, it was just easy to make that organizational split. And so I took one manager, made him a manager, and the manager that was his manager became just responsible for one area. And the manager just was upset. And I never really got clear about where we were going and how we could do it together. I just told them. Some of them were perfectly okay with it, but enough of them weren't that it disrupted our ability to get things done. That person eventually left. She was really good. I hated to see her leave. And at the time I was young, I was like, whatever, she doesn't know anything. I was silly to say that. And I saw her subsequently and said, you know what? I could have done that differently. And we probably would have had a great working relationship and done some great things if I had. And she acknowledged her faults as well, but I wish I would have done that differently. So the best thing is to know that there's emergence, to know that structure creates behavior, and to know that you need to have your people come along with you intentionally and constantly, consistently, or you're going to have to go back to the drawing board, and all of that internal tension and the complexity behind it isn't worked out and we don't make sense together. And it just slows you down from being able to do your best work with each other.
That's really cool. Thank you. I'm super interested, actually. I know that you've done a ton of work around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I'm really fascinated at what you've learned across that discipline or area and how you see that impacting. And I think you've touched on it around including people in conversations, but can you talk to me about what are the surprise learnings for you in the areas you've talked to people as it relates to organization design or organization structure?
I think one of the biggest things that I've discovered to date is that a lot of people don't consider that most of their challenges lie inside of the way their organization is designed. Because you guys have probably heard this 1,000 times. Most people think about org design as the org chart. So they don't even think about org design in any more robust manner. And so they don't think about whether their strategy is aligned with what they say they want people to be. So I don't know any organization that doesn't want an inclusive organization with inclusive leaders that create a sense of belonging for everybody. Their strategy doesn't align with that. Their reward systems don't align with that. The way that they do everything from candidate attraction or talent attraction all the way through somebody leaving their organization is not aligned with that mindset. The DEI as a practice is not accessible to everyone. So it seems like it's for the so-called marginalized, which is a really heavy term when you say marginalized, because oftentimes we attribute it to group identity. I think about my own experience. Am I marginalized because I happen to be darker skinned or African-American or Black, whatever people call me? It's just not true. I've been wildly privileged, and I live in Switzerland, just to put that in there, Tim. So the idea that DEI is for them is what I think gets people caught up. You start structuring any kind of shifts in structure or shifts in policy or actions become targeted towards particular groups. And that doesn't align with everybody. And so you end up out of alignment almost by nature. And some people think this is for a group and not for me. And so for me, when you're designing your organization and you're thinking about inclusion, you're asking the right questions around your design policies from the outset, you end up just making it more naturally built into your organization. And so I have a client that I'm going to be working with. I've been working with them. We've been doing a lot of work with them around strategies. I've had conversations with hundreds of people in the organization now, some broad group conversations with appreciative inquiry. Some have been one-to-one with top leadership. Some have been small groups that are working on certain projects. So I've talked to a lot of people and synthesized that data. And the reality is everybody's saying the same thing about the way the organization is structured, but they don't have a framework for what structure looks like. And so the next steps that we're taking are looking at the various areas of their organization design to put their culture and DEI strategy together so that it's aligned and people know that it's about everybody, that it's unambiguously prioritized because we want things to be different so we can achieve the mission that is quite grand and everybody is aligned with that. And then, of course, that it's sustainable, that we align it with organizational purpose so it can be sustained because everybody gets it. So people miss building this into pieces of their organization, and whether they call it organizational design or not, they need to build it into how power is used, but they need to build it into their strategy first. They need to build it into how teams work and information shared. They need to build it into the rewards and recognition structure, and of course, into the candidate employee experience. So that's the space where a lot of clients, a lot of mostly external, don't get that. When I was internal, interestingly, even the HR function didn't get that. And I didn't realize it to the extent that I do now. In retrospect, it's a lot clearer. We never even talked about org design except for talking about org charts. A lot of people understood matrix organizations and all those iterations of it, but they didn't understand what needed to follow behind that. And oftentimes the nature of inclusion was lost in a bevy of activities, but not in something that actually could be sustained because it was a part of the expectations of people every day.
You mentioned when you were starting out, Amri, that even HR weren't thinking about it so much. Have you been seeing a shift in the companies you've been working with the people you've been having conversations with through your own consulting firm? Is there more of a general knowledge coming through organizations? Is it ramping up?
If I was to be honest with you, which I will be right now, Amy, no. I think the larger organizations are outsourcing it to really qualified companies that do this work well. So those organizations are aware of it within the HR. I don't know if it's translated into the leadership, where the leadership understands that, hey, if I can just design my organization for what I say I want and include as many people as I can, and if I don't include them directly, I'm including them some way indirectly, and that they understand where they sit in the strategy at any point in time. They know this is how I make my best contribution, and this is what I need to thrive in making that contribution. You go a lot further, but I don't think a lot of HR departments put that forward as a set of capabilities for their people. I think if we built those skills and capabilities, which is really a big part of what we do, is building the skills and capabilities for people to create what I call anti-fragile organizations, organizations that can get through any challenge and be stronger as a result. It's the weightlifting for the organizational mind in a way. I don't think we're building those capabilities, those skills, that understanding. They don't have to be expert at it, but they have to understand that every single thing they do when it comes to the work that I'm into, diversity, tension and complexity of difference and similarity, inclusion, creating the capabilities or creating the conditions for people to thrive and the organization to create extraordinary value. And equity is identifying things that might be getting in the way of people doing their best work from thriving and making sure we adjust and change things in the organizational systems, policies, and structures to prevent it. So I'm an epidemiologist. I'm into prevention more than treatment. So a lot of times people are really focused on, in DEI, focused on fixing the problem. And I found, and the problem with problem focus is if you look for something, you'll find it. So if that's where your attention is, if your attention's on racism, if your attention's on sexism, if your attention's on whatever-ism, it's there without a doubt. Are you building the capabilities that people recognize it without you having to be the DEI police? And I think if organizations knew that, if HR knew that you could build this into how things get done, and when people see it, they can address it without it being punitive. It's just, hey, we need to rethink this. Let's work on this for a period of time. And this could be any input into the organizational mind or into that team, whatever it might be that they can put into practice so that they're building the capabilities. And if they leave the organization, they leave better and they go to their organization and have those skills and capabilities as well. So if we really want this DEI space to be material for organizations, putting it into the organization of design and letting people understand what that means, I think could go a long, long way. Get back to your question. We're not there yet. And I don't know if most organizations are determined to get there.
If we were to move it outside HR and leadership capability, two questions. Do you think it's possible for there to be advocates within the organization outside of that space? And if someone was listening and they feel like that person, is it possible to start tackling their org design with this inclusive mindset from their space, or does it need to be a broader organizational conversation? Can there be ground movement?
Absolutely. I think there could be ground movement anywhere. Yeah. They have to have some level of influence. If they're influencers in the organizational network, I'd say absolutely building that capability is possible. I would want the HR function to dance with them because you still need evangelists to continue to blast it. And oftentimes a lot of HR people have capabilities in there inside of that, even if it's just adjacent capability. OD, who it's often in HR, I think sometimes it'd be nice if it wasn't, to be honest with you. I think that if HR and OD dance without a power conversation or without power dynamics kind of getting in the way, I think both would be more effective because they would partner more. I think it would help, and I've seen some organizations do it. But yeah, anybody that has an operational role, anybody that has a role that builds capability, it could be L&D, the marketing manager, the sales manager that needs to be able to build the pipeline, get what behaviors are needed there, both internally and externally. Yeah, I think it could happen. I think it takes work and it takes somebody committed to learning in that regard. But I do believe that the capabilities can be built. And I don't think they should be built without HR. I hope HR would be firmly involved, even if they don't initiate it, that they could join in, but they don't need to necessarily be in the lead of it.
Hey there, listeners. Quick question. How well does your organization's design actually support your strategic goals? If you're not sure, it's time to find out with the Org Design Maturity Assessment brought to you by our sponsor, Functionly. This free assessment takes just 12 minutes and gives you a fully tailored report on where your organization stands across key domains, from structure and strategy to AI readiness. Take the assessment now at assessment.functionly.com.
I've got a different way that I want to ask a question about the problem. I think it's so interesting to hear your experience in this area. All the time, I'm sure you speak to them too. We're talking to leaders, and I just feel like they're super fearful. When you say, oh, you know, diversity and inclusion, you just watch, they're like, I'm like, why are you holding your breath? And what do you think? And I think you've touched on a little bit, but what are people feeling out there that are preventing them from taking action? What's the fear that they're feeling as a leader? Maybe you've been in the leader 20 years, and all of a sudden you feel like these things have been demanded of you either from corporate or you're seeing it is an important move and you're really just uncertain. What's stopping people taking action? Why don't they want an organization where everyone feels like they belong, fit, and are a part of the journey of achieving the outcome of the organization's mission?
I don't think that they've had that paradigm put upon them. I think they've had the paradigm of we're going to fix the problems of all those people have been oppressed in the past. And I think that paradigm, which one of my mentors and heroes in the DEI space in the U.S. named Roosevelt Thomas, he broke down these paradigms of diversity. And there were the social justice, civil rights paradigms of the 60s U.S., you know, fix the past wrongs. Those were the civil rights and social justice paradigms. the performance paradigms, which he developed as he was building out his work. And he wrote a book in 1991 called Beyond Race and Gender. You all hear what year I said that? In 1991.
Mm.
This was an African-American man. He went to my college. He was a graduate of Morehouse College, where I went to school, and Martin Luther King and Spike Lee and Samuel Jackson and a few others, right? Dr. Thomas said the performance paradigms is the uniqueness of every individual is considered so that they can get what they need to make their best contribution to the organization. Thus, my definition of inclusion, creating the conditions for everybody to thrive and for the organization to be generative. And then, of course, the fact that diversity isn't just amongst group identities and human types. There's the diversity of role. There's a diversity of geography. Living in Switzerland, I've never experienced the diversity of language that I experience now. These things are really well outside the Anglosphere context for a lot of people. I think if leaders saw that DEI had the paradigm of creating the conditions for all individuals to thrive, and it doesn't mean that there's not overlap between individuals, but it does mean that the conversation is not about righting past wrongs, full stop, because it doesn't work. If it worked, I would sit here and just champion it here on your podcast. But the reality is that it doesn't. I have experience where I've had to go into organizations, and I can't say stories with names because I've had to go in after they've done a lot of stuff on social justice and racial equity. And it was all well-meaning, but it just, they didn't have the alignment of the organization in mind when they started. So going back to organization design, if they thought about all the pieces and levers that you can pull to get people to understand that this is about the interdependence of how things get done. And if you do this well, you just get better results. It's not about, you know, them. I'm not trying to pick on you, Tim, but it's usually, it's not about you white guys being a part. It's about we. That's what's happened. We haven't actually created that space the way we could have. And the result is people are like, oh, DEI, yeah. You guys couldn't hear me and neither can the organization. So they automatically think they don't care, but they don't necessarily fully get why it's important beyond just recruiting people that have a skin tone closer to mine. There's a lot of qualified people out there. Are you casting the net the way you need to cast it if you're just talking about talent acquisition? But even if you get the people in, how do you keep them? How do you get them to do their best work? How do you get them to tell their friends to come and work with you? That's the magic. And I think if you gave people that framing, they wouldn't have that worry because they would be like, oh, this is just part of how business gets done. It's not this extra thing that we have to bolt on and spend money on.
Yeah. I don't know which leaders need to hear that, but I just feel like there's so much fear and misunderstanding about that. And I'm obviously in the US at the moment, but we have companies we work with all around the world in different geographies with different localized challenges. So I just think that's such a good way of thinking about it. I really, really appreciate you unpacking.
One quick addendum. There's skills and capabilities that you need to build. You need to build really robust listening skills. And everybody says that, but they don't always frame it as an inclusion skill, right? These skills, some people call them durable skills. I use lots of different words. A set of inclusion skills will get you a long way in getting stuff done. Well, that's what we spend our time with leaders on, so that they can be prepared for anything that happens and be able to bounce back from it quickly. I think everybody can sign up for that.
Yeah. I did want to make sure we mentioned your book, which is Reconstructing Inclusion, for those who want to go a little bit deeper. We'll make sure in the show notes, we pop the link in as well. And you're the CEO of Inclusion Wins. If I'm sitting out there listening to the podcast, how do I know I'm a good fit for Inclusion Wins? How do I know I've got the symptoms that are a good fit or the outlook that's a good fit to get in contact with you guys?
I think if you want to create organizational systems that create adaptiveness across your organization with the lens of inclusion, we're a good fit. What we work with, or a size in terms of numbers of up to about 1,500. So we work with regional elements of big companies, but mostly our clients are less than 1,500 people.
Awesome.
Amri, I'd love to know more about how the book idea came about, the company, the podcast. Also check that out. What's the problem you kept seeing repeated?
And the problem that kept being repeated, and actually it got exacerbated during the pandemic and after the murder of George Floyd, where we doubled down on group identity. to such an extent that we didn't look at even this notion of intersectionality that a lot of people talk about in the social justice space. They didn't think about the multidimensionality of humans, and that even though I might have a certain group identity that I really strongly adhere to, it's just one part of who I am. And when I say I don't mean Omri, I mean the generic I, right? Because of that, people weren't really taking into consideration the tensions and complexities that go along with just being human with each other. They went about it as trying to fix a problem that was about underrepresentation of these groups of people. Could have been women, it could have been underrepresented minorities. And so I kept looking at that, and what I'd had the chance to do at Novartis from the outset, our former president, Mark Fishman, when I was at the research division, he was really clear that this was about culture and what he called a sociology of innovation. He had me there. He wasn't like a salesman, but he might as well have been, because I was like, what? A sociology of innovation? How do you create the conditions for that? That's everything I had read most of my organizational effectiveness career. And so we had this space to experiment with the external world, with scientists from all over the world. We had a chance to experiment and bring in students that couldn't get into top PhD and MD PhD programs to cultivate and curate them. We had a chance to work from strategy all the way through how things were getting done every day. A theory of change emerged out of that for me that was focused on social networks or organizational networks, that was focused on cultural intelligence, and that was focused on what I call inclusion system design. Bringing all those together, the book emerged along with my little skepticism of what was going on at the time. I'd written part of it, a lot more technical, and then George Floyd came and I was like, yeah, this isn't going to work. It's going to end in a poor way. And we're seeing that play out. I was hoping I'd be wrong, kind of. I wasn't necessarily hoping. I was pretty sure I was going to be right. This so-called backlash that's happening now is because we didn't structure our work toward building the systems that could create the capabilities for everybody to thrive. We were just focused on the symptoms. And focusing on the symptoms is always a short-term play. And inclusion, equity is always a long-term play. And so the book is really about how do you create those conditions over time, build the capabilities over time, and all the things and inputs that go into making that a reality.
Amazing. Well, thank you for your time and your humility to chat with us and all your experience and specifically your inclusive lens to org design. We believe there's no perfect org, although I think I much preferred your term, which was designing durable organizations. So they're always emerging, they're emergent. And we hope that by listening to each other, we can constantly be learning and evolving our org design skills and building better places to work. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was so good, Maria. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast. That was really cool. Personally, I'm feeling impacted now with the conversation. So thanks so much for giving us your time from Switzerland. Just as we wrap the podcast, we want to thank our sponsor, Functionally. The link's always in the show notes or on LinkedIn. We also encourage other people or Omri, if you know someone that you think would be a great fit for the pod, but we have a simple form that you can refer someone in or nominate yourself if you're out there and you're an org designer and have something to add to the conversation for all these kind of everyday leaders out there doing their very best, burning candle at both ends, leading their organization, often swimming in a sea of problems like Omri talked about and needing to think a lot more about the machine that they're building or the system that they're building rather than the symptoms, to use your words, Omri. Would love to have you on the show to share your story with all of those people looking for solutions to their challenges. One thing we can ask for our listeners is to subscribe to the content. You'll get the latest content as it drops. So you can do that on whatever platform you listen along to the podcast on. Omri, it was an absolute freaking pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was delightful.